brief as far as the emission control computer and the dashboard computer. You'll get the most amount of power out of your transmitter. Other than that, it's good. Please do it that way if you possibly can. If you're having somebody do that installation, even though they're going to give you flack and they would say, gee, why do I have to run a negative lead when the whole car is grounded? Why can't I just ground it locally and only run one lead back to the battery? I recommend you insist on two leads going all the way. Also, the various portions of the sheet metal of the car, the body of the car, the fenders and the hood over the trunk and whatever, those various portions of the sheet metal, in order not to make noisy connections as you drive down the road and the car is being vibrated by the bumps in the road, in many cases, those pieces of sheet metal are suspended from the chassis with rubber buggy bumpers, let me call it. And so, in some cases, those pieces of sheet metal are floating. And maybe in some cases, as the sheet metal is being vibrated by the road noise, so to speak, they intermittently make contact to the chassis, and it will make radio noise. What Mel has done inside the automobile in critical places, he has put in a flexible braid, a copper flexible braid, between the chassis, the bumper, and the various pieces of sheet metal of the car. He has bonded them together with flexible pieces of copper braid so that no longer is there intermittent contacts which can make radio noise into an HF antenna. You probably won't have that problem with VHF, but if you're operating on, let me pick a number, the 14 megacycle band, these extra bonding techniques can make a quieter rig. You may have a rig that works beautifully when you're parked, but when you're driving at 40 miles an hour, you get some funny clicking noises because these chunks of sheet metal are moving around and they're not being electric.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
These funny pieces of electronic, of sheet metal are not being properly bonded. They're moving around and making clicking noises. Back to you, Angel. KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Okay, one more question. On grounding the base of the antenna, would that be properly to ground it back to the battery, or is that going to be on a chassis?
Almost nobody runs a separate lead from the base of the antenna back to the battery. There you don't have to do it. You're doing it for the power that goes into the rig. The antenna itself, in most cases, it does get screwed down to the chassis, and that works very well. There have been a few people who were getting some noise of that particular piece of sheet metal that the return lead of the antenna was connected to. Since the antenna was being fed by coaxial cable directly from the transmitter, there have been a few people who insulated the antenna by putting a fiber or a fiberglass washer or a nylon washer in there, so that when they tighten down that great big nut that connects the antenna to the piece of sheet metal, that the antenna was being insulated at that point. A few people have done that, and they thought they saw improvement. I don't recommend you start off there. Screw it down to the sheet metal and try that. 99% of the time, that works very well. There, you don't need a separate lead. It's only for the power going to the rig that you need these separate red and black leads with a separate fuse on both of those wires back at the battery. Back to you, Angel, K2RAW.
Roger there. I work with a lot of electricians, and I'm an electrician myself, and people have the misunderstanding of neutral and ground. When you do the neutral in the house, people tend to say, well, I'm going to run the wire right to ground, and I got a neutral. Well, at the panel, they both tied it together. But before that, what happens is that your load is going to run through your whole house. And eventually, one day, you have a nick in a bathtub, and you'll feel electricity running through you. You won't find out. You won't know what happened. That's why the ground is supposed to be like undesirable current. So in DC is different. So that what happens. That's why I wouldn't go to just right to the straight of the body of the car and straight to the body. I would go straight to the battery. And I understand it now. Thank you.
When it comes to household wiring, you're into a fairly critical area that sometimes is misunderstood, Angel. There are three wires coming out of that pole pig transformer in front of your house, the utility transformer on top of the utility pole. I'm going to call it the red lead, the black lead, and the neutral lead. Red and black has something like 230, 240 volts across them. The neutral is each side roughly 120 volts to neutral. That neutral lead from the case of the pole pig transformer back to your fuse panel should have a small fraction of an ohm of total resistance, and very good contact all the way is required. If anything goes wrong there, if the neutral becomes floating in your house, and the most critical connection is between that transformer and your fuse panel, the extra grounding at your house is belt and suspenders, but proper wiring between that transformer and your house is the most critical part. If anything goes wrong with that neutral wiring to the transformer, there's a high probability you end up with what you described, funny currents in the house, and the so-called dim-bright problem, where half the house is getting 160 volts and the other half of the house is getting 85 volts, so to speak. Things become unbalanced if that neutral back to the transformer does not have high integrity. And that happened in my case, for instance, where that neutral wire was an aluminum wire. It eventually built up corrosion at the weatherhead where the wiring enters the house, and that crimped connection made poor contact, and I had a dim bright problem in my house until I called up the Long Island Lighting Company at the time, and they came and redid that particular connection. That kind of a problem, let me drop. The so-called dim bright problem does not really occur in an automobile. As long as you've got the plus and minus lead from the transmitter running all the way back to the battery, and ground the antenna right at the sheet metal, 99% of the time that works like a charm. Back to you, Angel. KC2ERR, K2LIW.
Yeah, that's good. I was installing my mount for my HF antenna, and the problem is that I think I got to scrape down the there's a lot of paint built up in that base. I don't think it's a good ground, and my friend told me to put an extra wire from the base of the antenna to a good part of the metal, because I'm not getting a good ground. I'm holding the mount, but I'm not getting a good ground from the vehicle. So that's why I was asking this question on grounding, and because very important. I mean, is the ground, and right now there's a lot of people that have problems with grounds when it comes to living in an apartment. After so many, if you live on a fourth floor and you want to make it down to the ground, that's not probably a good ground, because it becomes like almost like an antenna, right? Probably.
If you're on the 15th floor of an apartment building and you're running kind of an antenna which is single-ended, an unbalanced antenna which needs a local ground, that is a serious problem. And therefore, to run a kind of antenna that is symmetric, where the plus and minus lead out of the transmitter, so to speak, goes to the two halves of the antenna, like a dipole-like antenna, a balanced antenna. In that particular case, grounding for radio reasons is not required. You're grounding your equipment, in that case, for lightning protection reasons or human shock protection reasons, but not for radio reasons. In the case of your automobile installation, where the paint is so thick you may not be able to easily get through it with the mounting hardware for the antenna at the sheet metal, to run a completely separate wire from there as short as you possibly can to some place where you can make good contact to the sheet metal, yes, that is a good belt and suspenders technique. But keep that wire short, because it is an extra inductive length on the antenna. And if you run that wire 5 feet long to some other place that's convenient, you may not get quite the performance out of the antenna you would like. So that extra grounding wire internally to the sheet metal below the antenna, try to keep that one kind of short. And well, what's my definition of short? If you can keep it under 6 inches, I think you're doing a very good job. Over to you, Angel, K2LIW. My name is Dick.
Okay, so that'll be 6 inches, and what size of wire? 12 gauge, 14 gauge, because the wire we took out of the my friend antenna, the mount, we can see the burnt marks on the terminal. You can see the terminal was burnt, so it must take a load when it goes to ground.
I believe 14 gauge would be adequate. Let's see what Mel's got for an opinion on that one. I think 14 gauge would be adequate. K2KEY, what's your opinion on that small 6-inch long extra grounding lead at the mount where the antenna screws through the sheet metal? K2KEY, K2LIW.
Oh, Kyle's got 14 wire would be adequate. More than adequate. The question is, I don't understand, what does he mean by that? They saw a burn mark. How did he develop a burn mark in that situation at the antenna deck over?
I've got a guess on that one, Mel. If he's running, let me pick a number, 100 watts, 150 watts on a mobile rig, and if the base of a quarter-wave-like antenna, a whip-like antenna, mounted at the sheet metal, is isolated from the sheet metal so that the counterpoise return for that antenna is taking place through the long transmission line all the way back to the rig, and the antenna is essentially mechanically connected to the sheet metal but electronically floating from the sheet metal. He's putting hundreds of volts of RF energy into that antenna, and if the base of the antenna is floating by hundreds of RF volts because it's got this great big inductive path through the transmission line, outer layer of the transmission line, the outer current flowing down the transmission line back to the antenna, he could have hundreds of RF volts between the base of the antenna and the sheet metal. And if there's a very short gap there and he's arcing through that gap periodically, you will see a burnt mark. So a thoroughly floating system could do that. And his 6-inch long piece of 14-gauge wire, in my opinion, would have thoroughly avoided that problem. I wonder if you see that picture, Ramel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I could see that, but why doesn't he see it on the sheet metal? You had an antenna, a mag mount antenna or something like that. Usually, the bottom mount has some kind of like a felt, you know, so you don't tear up your paint and all. But if it did arc, if you didn't have that and you had direct contact to the sheet metal, would the sheet metal show also a burn over?
I think in many cases the base of the antenna has a rubber grommet, a rubber-like material, to make sure that water from the outside world does not pour into that hole where the antenna is mounted. So the base of the antenna on the outside of the sheet metal where the paint is insulated. It's only the capturing nut mechanism on the inside of the sheet metal that in theory is supposed to supply the grounding by way of a great big star washer. And if they had some extra paint in that area that the star washer did not cut through, you could now have hundreds of volts across that gap, and therefore on the inside of the sheet metal, you're going to see some burn marks when you remove the antenna. That's what I think he's talking about. I don't think the burn marks occurred on the outside because the rubber grommet to do weatherproofing gave you protection there. I think the burn mark was on the inside. Let's see if Angel can confirm that. Over to you, Angel, K2LIW.
Roger, that when we took the mount off his vehicle, and we took off the ground, we saw the burnt marks on the terminal. Now, my question is, would it be wise to scrape down the area where I'm going to clamp down to the mount of antenna, or just use a piece of ground wire to piece of ground with a 6-inch ground wire to a metal surface?
There's no easy answer on that one, Angel. As you scrape away more and more of the paint on the sheet metal, on the inside of the sheet metal, where the antenna is about to be mounted, you're going to be making that sheet metal in that area more subject to being rusted. I mean, there's all kinds of undercoat and protection cone and primer and whatever they put on a modern-day automobile. If this is the best of all worlds, we would love to have stainless steel, just like the DeLorean automobiles, for all of the sheet metal in our car. Well, that's too expensive, and we'd never have a rusting problem in that case. We've all got rustable steel in our car. So there's all kinds of fancy primer and undercoat to try to avoid the rust. How much of that you scrape away, where you scrape it away, and how you do that local grounding. Each guy is going to do it differently. You're between a rock and a hard place here, Angel. You're trying to make good local grounding to get highest performance out of the antenna. But in the process of doing that, you don't want to scrape away so darn much of these protective coatings on the sheet metal that now you create a rusting problem. Because if the hole around the antenna eventually turns into a pile of rust and the sheet metal becomes weakened and the antenna falls off, you're going to be unhappy with what happens to the antenna, and the wife is going to give you flack as to the way the car looks. So you're going to have to use your judgment as to where you scrape, and keep in mind that any place that you scrape, if you don't then go do some extra protection afterward, is subject to being rusting at some later time. Over to you, Angel, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger there. One more thing. I saw in the magazine I think it's Tar Heel antenna, that's the one I have. They have like a ground plane. Can I use that while I'm stationary, and would it give me the reflection that I need if I put it underneath the vehicle with the wires sticking out like a pie, and that hooked up to the base of the antenna? Would that give me a good ground plane?
Angel, you've gone back to shouting into that microphone, and boy, are you loud.
Wow.
You are really loud. Mel, did you understand the question? K2KEY, K2RIW?
What I assume, he wants to make a temporary radial or counterpoise if the car is in a, you know, sort of a so-called set place. Can you do that? I used to go, like, for instance, to Marine Park here. Marine Park had an extensive radial system that was laid down many, many years ago during World War II, because they had a number of radio towers there that was for training the Navy pilots to land at night, especially by using radios, early versions of navigation systems. So they put that up at Marine Park, and so that parking lot had a nice system of radios that were basically for very low frequency, because that original stuff was all HF, low frequency HF. So I used to put the car, I used to go in there with the car fixed, and I'd work out real well, because I had a counterpoise basically right under the car there that extended through the entire parking lot. He wants to do the same thing. I've heard of hams that would do that, you know, would just put a clip with a number of wires and just laying them out when they were stationary mobile. But I still don't understand what he meant by the terminal arcing. What terminal is that? He means the ground from the coax, the shield terminal. He had a terminal there, and that was what's arcing. I didn't quite understand that, Dick, over.
I'm guessing that the antenna itself, you drill a round hole, let me pick a number, 1.5 inches in diameter. You stick the coax down through that hole, and the outer portion of the antenna with its rubber grommet makes contact with the outer sheet metal, and then there is some kind of a star washer and great big nut that goes on the inside. I think he's calling that a terminal. and that star washer hopefully digs through the inner protective coating on the sheet metal, on the inside of the sheet metal, and it mechanically connects the antenna. That's the way many installations take place. And so he's calling that a terminal on the inside. There probably is a place where you can put an extra piece of wire. That's where he's going to put his piece of 14-gauge wire over to some kind of a grounding lug that he knows makes good contact to the sheet metal at some nearby place. That's the terminal I think he's talking about. So we're going to pass it back to Angel for a clarification on that. Also, anything you can do to make an external set of ground plane radials from a mobile installation usually will give you increased performance, because the automobile itself, let me drop it, on HF frequencies, the automobile is such a small fraction of a wavelength that it doesn't give you quite the adequate counterpoise that you would like to get full performance out of the antenna, particularly if you happen to be driving over very sandy soil. You park your automobile alongside of the seashore where there's nice water, salty water on the soil underneath, high conductivity soil, you get usually better performance on an HF antenna. And adding extra ground plane radials when you're stopped and parked for a long period of time at a field day site, that could give you extra performance. And I think there have been people who have run that experiment. Back to you, Angel, and try not to talk so loud. KC2, Echo Romeo Romeo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger there. No, no. The wire, we took out when we took the base off, he had a piece of ground wire. And there was a piece of wire that had a terminal on it that screwed onto the base of the antenna, and the other side was screwed onto a piece of metal. A good, clean metal. And the other side of the terminal was really, really burnt. And I reckon that there is some kind of voltage RF going through there, and that's why it looked it burnt. And my friend said, well, get a new lug and hook it up to the ground. But I just wanted to get some clarification, because I remember when I started with the FT100, I had it for many years when I first started, and I used to have problems with grounds, and I couldn't understand it. And, you know, I got wiser and talked to people, and at this time I want to get more performance out of my equipment, since I spent a lot of money on it. So at this time I want to go a little bit better with more a knowledge of it, so the more tools you have, the better results you're going to get out of your rig.
It does sound like that extra 14-gauge piece of wire going over to its lug sounds like that's where you got the burn marks. And that would not take place if that particular lug was really well connected to the sheet metal. Quite possible that lug was mechanically screwed down to the sheet metal, but again, there was a layer of paint underneath that you were arcing through. That's a guess as to what was making that burn marks. You will not get a burn mark if the base of the antenna is well bonded radio-wise to the sheet metal. You will not get any burn marks. So with your extra 14-gauge piece of 6-inch long or less wire, or the star washer digging in and really making contact, there's ways you can confirm that. By disconnecting the coax cable from the transmitter so that it is thoroughly floating. But now you measure with your ohmmeter between the outer shield of the coax cable and the sheet metal of the car. And you'd like to measure a small fraction of 1 ohm, meaning you've got real good contact. If it doesn't pass that test, then you've got some more work to do to scrape through paint to make sure you're getting good grounding, or using soldering, welding, brazing, whatever. Some other technique is required. I do recommend you disconnect the cable from the rig and measure with your ohmmeter how well is the base of your antenna being grounded to the sheet metal. Your ohmmeter will show that to you. Good luck with that project, Angel. Please come back and tell us how well it worked. Now, there's one further thing I was going to tell you about this telephone situation. Let me drop. Your radio... not-so-well-informed friends times you are known as radio operators in your places of business. They're going to be asking you about this 7% increase in the metabolism of a person in a PET scan machine when a cell phone is running full power for 50 solid minutes. People are going to ask you about that. Does that represent a danger? I think the chances are very slim. That falls well into the testing procedures that have already been done for lots and lots of years by the American Standard Institute, ANSI, American Standard Institute, which is a division of the IEEE, the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers. And it is that document, the ANSI document called C95, Charlie 95 document, that is the defining document for the whole darn United States, whether you're talking about OSHA, NIOSH, Department of Defense, whatever, all at FCC, all of those standards set by all of those agencies refer back to that very document. And that document, the C95 ANSI document, defines the best of what we know in the United States after 60 years of measurement. The latest version of the document has more than 1,200 references by the world's best testing laboratories and institutions that have been making these measurements for 60 years. So this is not a fly-by-night operation. IPERP is the name of this organization worldwide that gathers this information. The Bureau of Radiological Health for the United Kingdom has a similar document with very similar numbers and research of all of their research. Germany has one. Japan has one. Australia has one, and so on. Or probably Canada has one. Lots and lots of countries have been studying the effects of radio energy on human beings. And so this is not a brand new situation.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The people who are uninformed about radio frequency biohazard will often use an argument like this. For years and years, people were using cigarette smoking. They thought it was safe, and we eventually found out it wasn't. For years and years, lots of asbestos was in our environment. We thought it was safe. We eventually found out it wasn't. And now for years and years, we've been using radio, and we're going to find out it's unsafe. That's a logical sounding set of words. It doesn't hold water. Because in the case of radio, it has been well studied since the 1940 time frame when radars and other high-power radio pieces of equipment were starting to be installed on airplanes during World War II. That study has been going on ever since. And so lots and lots of data is there. You read that report, and you'll be unhappy about the fact that it's so darn technical, but all of those words are traceable back to the National Bureau of Standards of this country, as well as the equivalent Bureau of Standards of many other countries. So this is not a fly-by-night rapidly derived operation. And so for a community anywhere in the United States or the rest of the world to say that radio is dangerous and we have to avoid it, you can make that decision. You can do that in your private life if you like. But in the 21st century, you can't get away from radio. You're going to be living with it. And let me give you an example of what I'm talking about. I got a panic call from my good buddy on Friday afternoon. He is teaching a graduate level course in electrical engineering of radio circuits at Brooklyn Polytech Institute. And in the process of him describing how these radio circuits work, he happened to mention the word ham radio and the fact that ham radio operators do this kind of work as a hobby. I don't know the exact number, but maybe there were 20 students in that class. And these are graduate students, so they're probably more than 22 years of age in general. And he got a bunch of blank looks on their face. Deer in the headlight response. He then asked them the question, have you ever heard of ham radio? No response. They had never heard of it. He then said, have you ever heard of citizens band radio? Because ham radio is a higher class version of citizens band. They had never heard of citizens band. And they said, okay, what is this? And he described ham radio as a geeky type operation, people who like technology and they experiment with it, where they build transmitters and receivers and study propagation and find out how far the radio signal will go on various frequencies. The students started asking him, why in the world would anybody do that? And he suddenly realized what's going on here. These people have grown up with social networking. A zillion ways they talk to each other. Let me drop. There's a zillion ways they talk to each other with Facebook and all these other things. And their cell phones and their pagers and everything else. All of this radio equipment that they have been using for all of their adult life. They have never asked the question, what is it? How does it work? What's behind the front panel? From that point of view, you buy a cell phone or a similar like device, iPad, iPod, whatever. You choose the one that's the right color, the right size, that fits into your pocket. You pay for the service. You dial up whoever you want or whatever website you want, whatever. You upload, you download, and you do all this kind of work. And for them, that's all you need this equipment for. How it works, they don't care. The fact that they need cell sites and the access points, they don't care, they don't know. What's behind the front panel, they don't know. The majority of users don't even carry a spare battery. They'll use some strong, salty language if the darn thing goes dead in between the times that they charge it. If they're going out and they hit the land somewhere, they never even consider the fact that the battery could go dead. And when they demanded that they buy a smaller and smaller one that fits more and more conveniently in their pocket, the fact that there's less and less volume and weight for the battery, they don't even worry about those details. They don't care about what's behind the front panel. Let me drop. From our point of view, these are appliance operating people. They are appliance operators. That's a slang that we use, a derogatory slang we use in the ham radio world. A guy who buys a rig, he plugs it in, he gets in front of the microphone, and he starts talking about whatever is his favorite subject, but it's usually not technical. That's an appliance operator. A real ham radio operator wants to know, what is behind the front panel? How does that phase lock loop work? What is its frequency stability? How accurate is its spectral purity? What is the harmonics like coming out? How many watts? What efficiency? What power comes out? How good is the transmission line? How good is the antenna? How high is the antenna? How many people can I talk to? Over how much range? On what band? During what status of the sunspot cycle? And so on. We get into the details. And so my poor friend was dumbfounded by the lack of exposure of this, what we think is a massive region. And he knows, unfortunately, this guy is a guy who really knows RF. He was hired for about a five-year period of time by the Hewlett Packard Corporation as being their local expert on how to use vector network analyzers and spectrum analyzers. The really tough problems, you went back to Mike, and Mike gave you the answer. He really understood how RF works. Mike happens not to be a ham radio operator. He should be, but he's not. And therefore, when he was dumbfounded by these students not knowing what in the world he's talking about, he panicked, and he called me up and said, what the hell should I say to these people? And the best I could tell him is that, let me drop, that the ham radio operators are a very rare breed. It's a subculture. There's one ham radio operator per 500 people in the general population of this country. And you get very similar numbers in almost all of the developed nations. Roughly one per 500. You also get one per 500 pilots, private pilots. So these are a very small fraction of the population. If I got it correctly, I think it's 0.2%. Yeah, I think it's 0.2% of the population are ham radio operators. And what is a ham radio operator? A guy who wants to know not the fact that it works, how does it work, why does it work, what's behind the front panel, how do I make it work better? Those cell phones that all of these kids grew up with, and they think that they've been there from the year one, that was invented by a ham radio operator. An unsung hero named Dr. Reed Fisher, all of a sudden I can't think of Reed Fisher's call letters. I know him very well. It'll come to me in a minute. He was working at Bell Laboratories in Murray Hill, New Jersey, 1970. I ran into Reed, W2CQH, Whiskey 2, Charlie Queen Hotel. I've talked to him many times on the 432 band back in the 70s while he was doing this work. And he was then visiting places in Japan that were going to be doing the massive manufacture of all of this equipment to support the cell phone concept. But he and the people who worked with him developed the concept then. You go to Google and Wikipedia and you find out who invented the cell phone, you get the name of a man from the Motorola Corporation. Let me drop. Who is given the credit. In reality, he had a staff, the guy at Motorola had a staff of people who set up the first operating cell site. And he made the first real over-the-air cell phone contact through his handheld cell phone, which was a great big hand, great big walkie-talkie-like thing, through that local cell site. And he made a call in New York City to a competing company, the president, took, a company that he was in competition with as far as radio equipment is concerned. That was the very first cell phone, and he's given the credit. He didn't invent it. It was invented by a ham radio operator. So the real people who make electronic progress in wireless equipment, I mean, you could say the very first cell phone was really a ham radio operator with a handy-talkie in his hand talking over a phone patch, a touch-tone, a keyable phone patch through a repeater. That was the very first cell phone, and that was being used back in the late 60s. So we hams have done an awful lot of this work, and the geeky guys who like this kind of technology become ham radio operators. But a substantial portion of the otherwise well-informed modern-day population of technology people taking graduate-level courses in radio engineering. Here he has something like 20 students in that class who had never heard of it. That is a bit shocking, but that's the modern way. You guys are rare animals. You might have some comments about this, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
RFN. WIE with a related question.
I heard RFN and WIE, but Mel first.
WB2, BXO.
And BXO, also in that order. Mel, go ahead.
Okay, very good. Well, let's pick up all the comments first, Vic. And the amount of, how can I put it, the amount of pioneering that went into what we do now. You know, we're sitting, as they say, standing on the shoulders of some great people. And the number of people that don't understand, let me put it to you this way. I will actually say I've had the same experience, boils down to the same experience. I was doing teaching up to last year. I was teaching in the city, and I asked the class to perform. I said, I have a hobby and an interest in amateur radio. These were also engineering students, and not a one acknowledged even knew of the existence of amateur radio. So I think for today's world, since the oncoming of the internet and everything like that, cell phones and all, and amateur radio doesn't, I know a lot of people will disagree with me, but it doesn't seem to have the appeal or of the days when we got our ham license, how proud we were and all, how people were impressed. And I think that sort of has taken a back step, Dick, over.
Yeah, it's a little bit sad for us old fogies. Mel and I consider ourselves older guys. I mean, we're not geniuses. You hear a lot of radio information out of us, and it's not becoming because we're super smart, got a super high IQ. We've been there, done that, been around a lot of years, been interested throughout the majority of our life in this subject. We've invested our life raison d'etre into this radio thing, and that's why we claim to know a little more about it than the general guy. Alan, what do you think about the whole story? KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2RFN, good evening, Dick and Mel, and Dick, we missed you at the ham fest. Yeah, I can confirm that story. I had a 22-year-old staffer, and I was talking about CB radio, and she was very polite but had that look. And I said, do you know what a CB is? She had no clue what it was, no idea. And perhaps the reason we're running into this problem where we might lose our 420 to 440 frequencies could be because of this ignorance on the part of the public as to what it is and what its importance is. So it's not just a disinterest on the part of the public, it's a general ignorance on the part of the public. And because of that, we may lose a chunk of our spectrum. But I'm not so sure it's just because, kids or anybody can just pick up a cell phone and call China. Interest in ham radio has been dying, at least since the 80s, because even in my school at the time, when I was in high school, it was very hard to get together a radio club. And when we did, we didn't even have ham radio. So there's something missing. But unfortunately, I think it's going to lead to our downfall, and it's already beginning because of this 420-440 loss. And I don't know if you want to make a few comments on that, if you know about that, Dick. Back to that.
Yes, I do. There's a bill before Congress now to take the 420 to 440 meg ham band. We own the so-called 432 band, we call it, or 450 band. Right now, we're the secondary user between 420 and 450 megacycles. And so somebody's concluding we're not really using 420 to 440. Well, you talk to the guys that are on 432 sideband, and they're going to strongly disagree with you. Yes, we are making heavier use of the 440 to 450 repeater region of 450 ham band. But those sidebanders, those where the progressive guys that are doing an awful lot of the research are located. And if you take that away, you're going to pay a price downrange. So we've got to fight that particular one. There's another point I was going to make, but I've forgotten it right now. Let me go over to the Eric is the next guy. I think it's Eric. KC2WIE. I wonder if you've heard of this situation going on, if it's Eric. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yes, Dick. It's Eric, KC2WIE. Getting back to the research surrounding the alleged ill effects of RF radiation and, in my mind, radiation associated with high voltage lines. Do you think the final chapter has been written in terms of research regarding those alleged ill effects? Back to you.
Of course not, Eric, and that's true of every field. There's a risk in everything we do. The safest thing I can think of is for you and I to consume an 8-ounce glass of pure, clean, cool water. You'd say that's the safest substance in the world. Well, something like 5 people per year die because they are college students hazing. In other words, they're trying to become a member of a particular fraternity, and they get involved in a competition as to who can consume the most amount of water in a 20-minute period. And some of these overly enthusiastic students will swallow tremendous amounts of water, upset their body chemistry, do physical damage, whatever. A certain amount of them die per year. So you can kill somebody with the most innocent thing in the world if you misuse it. So has the last word been written? Of course not. Obvious by the fact that the American National Standard Institute C95 report is now in, let's see, there was Rev A, B, C, D, E, I think it's in Rev F. Every 5 years or so, they redo it. And additional graphs and curves and additional measurements are reported on. And the specs keep becoming more and more conservative. At one time, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter used to be considered safe for a controlled area. And something like 3 or 5 milliwatts. Now, I think the current standard is 1 milliwatt per square centimeter is allowed for a uncontrolled area. Uncontrolled means whether or not the potential victim is informed or not informed as to whether or not there's a local radio transmitter that could be turned on. Let me drop. So for a bunch of reasons, the specs keep becoming a little bit more conservative, and the amount of data gathered and the interpretation of the data is increasing. And because the number of wireless products being used by the American public is continuously increasing, there's something like 5 billion cell phones in operation on planet Earth right now. If Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH, knew what he was involved in 1970, wow. If he could have looked at his crystal ball and seen the future, where this technique, which he thought was going to appeal to the geeky American citizens, that a small percentage of them would go for this. And now if you look at the proper list as to how many cell phones there are per country, there are certain countries, and I think Russia is one of them, and Germany is another one, where the total number of cell phones in use is 30% higher than the total population of every man, woman, and child in that country. A number of people no longer use a wireless phone. They have multiple cell phones. Some of them have one in the car, one in the purse, one at home, you know, one at the factory. So, to proliferate that much, could anyone have predicted that popularity? So the total amount of exposure we're getting, the total number of wireless products, is continuously increasing. We now want to have simultaneous data and voice, and we want to be talking to somebody. Let me drop this. We want to be talking to somebody in a handheld-like device in a conference call at the same time that all of us are uploading, downloading certain kinds of webnet programs or whatever. And you're talking to a guy that's 5,000 miles away. You and he both download the same program, and you're comparing your interpretation of what that particular website is saying. Simultaneous data and voice, among many other things. We're demanding more and more performance out of smaller and smaller packages with higher and higher capability. And so it's continuously going and written on the desktop computer that you're going to be using. Of course not. That's continuously going to be changing. You buy the state-of-the-art computer today, and 3 years from now, there's a high probability you're going to consider it a dinosaur, old-fashioned machine, because it's no longer running a 5 gigs of data rate with 3 simultaneous microprocessors. Over to you, Eric. KC2WIE for any other comments. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Let me apologize, Dick, for what may have seemed as a loaded question. You expressed my thoughts very well. In a matter of moments, you're going to be transitioning from RF radiation to magnetism. And that's my point. The research goes on. And how little we know about the composition and the effects of magnetism. I mean, you've spent already weeks discussing that single topic. And, you know, even the research may have to progress to a point where the instrumentation that we're using to discover what we need to know regarding just that simple area of magnetism may reap knowledge that we're just not capable of understanding today. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm rather glad that we're getting into magnetism, because I'm led to believe that the very first step of all the radio signals that you and I transmit, Eric, that when that signal first leaves the first micro-inch of that antenna, I'm led to believe it starts off as a magnetic wave. Yeah, we got that magnetic wave by putting some current through a certain portion of the antenna. And we got the current through the antenna, through the conductor portion of the antenna, by using voltage. So on the antenna itself, all kinds of voltage is flying back and forth. But the real beginning of what goes on into space, I'm led to believe it's magnetic. And I'd really like to know at the molecular level, at the atomic level, what in the world is going on there. Because that's the beginning of the Nile, if you know what I mean. That's where the rubber meets the road. It's where the process begins. You'd like to believe that the antenna is simultaneously generating a magnetic field and an electrostatic field, electrofield. It's not. To make an electrofield, you need electrons. In between the two plates, so to speak, you put more electrons on one and less on the other, and I'm making now an electric field. And I can reverse that periodically if I want. But you and I are not transmitting a single electron into space when we transmit that radio wave. So electronic wave ain't doing it, ain't hacking it. The magnetics is where the real smarts is. I'd love to understand more of it. And slowly we're walking each other through the woods of learning that one. Frank? WB2BXO, I bet you've run into some of these classes where the students have never heard of ham radio. WB2BXO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW.
Bernie recognized, but Frank first. Go ahead, Frank.
And I have a comment.
Yes,
sadly, Mel, most of the classes I teach the students have never heard of anything. Get into a long discussion about what I do. Anyway, I deal with a very serious set of social problems at work. Anyway, the point I wanted to raise is when I switched on the Academy Awards this evening, I heard a teaser for tomorrow night's 11 o'clock news where some reporter is going to explain how Wi-Fi causes infertility, supposedly. And I don't know if somebody with a lot of technical knowledge wants to look that up, find out who that reporter is, and try to get online or on the phone with them tomorrow before that goes on the air, and try to set them straight if, in fact, that's what he or she is going to try to say on the 11 o'clock news tomorrow night. Go ahead, Dick. I'm having a hard time not laughing at that one. WB2BXL.
Yeah, when you're in the media of a newspaper, radio, television, or whatever, news, broadcasting, to a certain degree, to be sensational is better than being accurate. If you're sensational, people will burn a path to your door, they'll listen to every word of what you said, and you'll have your 5 minutes of fame if you're sufficiently sensational. So a number of reporters, when given the choice, will take the sensational path as opposed to the accurate path. And so they get some little snippet of knowledge from somebody who did an experiment where the experiment itself is not done with good laboratory procedure, and the experiment is not a reproducible result that was given peer review. In other words, published in a good journal, and people with knowledge in the area were able to review the data, and hopefully other people in another laboratory duplicated the experiment and got the same result. Until you've been through that process, that's the real process of science, confirmation. A theory, a measurement, a confirmation, and peer review. Until you've been through that, you have no way of knowing whether or not it's somebody's harebrained idea that has nothing to do with the real world of the laws of physics and what Mother Nature really does. It could be somebody's harebrained assumption that he jumped to a conclusion, and he thinks he's right because he's carefully selected the data, and he threw out the outliers. You'd be amazed how many people, I run into that every day. Somebody's processing a whole bunch of data, and you find out, gee, a whole lot of this data ain't part of your analysis. Well, those are the outliers. That's the bad data. Oh? You threw out bad data. How did you know the data was bad? It's bad because it didn't fit your particular harebrained idea. You'd be amazed how many people fall into that trap. They have a preconceived notion, and they'll gather data that only supports the preconceived notion, and everything else is an outlier.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout.
Able.
Outlier and bad data, and gets thrown away. Bernie, I wonder if you've ever run into any of this jazz. And you're after Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
Good evening again, Dick. Very interesting conversation. Just to offer a couple of points of data. Number one, there are more hams, licensed ham operators today than there have ever been. But also the population is greater than it's ever been. We're currently in that aging phase of the baby boomer. So the fact that there are more hams statistically probably doesn't make a difference. Recently, meaning in the last 5 or 8 years, I started going back to school at night. And one of my experiences, I was on a campus with about 20,000 students, and I met two hams. One of them was a mathematics major, the other one was an undeclared major. Neither one was in a technical discipline per se, but there were two hams out of 20,000, so that's one in 10,000. So the shall we say, the numbers are there, but they're maybe not in the best discipline to be able to, shall we say, study RF and do anything about it. Just some practical data points I can give you from being down in the trenches.
K1FC.
K1FC recognized also. We're going to get to you to one more person. I think there's something like 600,000 hams in the United States. So the numbers are holding. We're not becoming an obsolete breed. Yeah, our average age is increasing. And the new youngsters are so unenamorated with wireless equipment. I mean, they got so much of it, they take it for granted. They assume that cell phone was always there from the beginning of mankind. They don't realize all the development procedure that had to go into that. Bernie, you're the, Wesley, you're the guy that got us into this heavy magnetic study. Look what you've created. We're a long way from being out of the woods on this one. We got a long way to go. But we're slowly learning more and more about what is magnetism, what is its magic. We haven't got the vaguest idea what are the individual lines of magnetic field, what they're made out of, but we're getting more and more experience as to how to generate them and how strong they can be made and so on. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
N2XJN. I would be very happy if you could take a look at the last email that I sent you just a few minutes ago. It's a set of questions, not many, and it's short, and the related literature. I think I found something really exciting. Exciting because we never spoke about, there was not even a single word about what I'm trying to cover in here. I sent you the links to a number of universities, so they are not amateurs, and labs studying about magnetic component of gravitational waves. We're talking about magnetism or magnetic field as something that is static. It's a force that does not do any job. And now we have something exciting. And I'm going to just give you one sentence. The forces of the magnetism, electricity, and gravity are simply different types of perturbations in a single field that permeate the universe and comprise the fabric of the existence. All the magnetism, electricity, and gravity interfere with each other, taking as the fact that the gravity has, in fact, magnetic component and is the wave. So, let me drop, and I'm going to go to the questions, and maybe by that time we'll be able to look at the email.
Maybe yes, maybe no. My hands are kind of full. Just looking at all of my notes, trying to keep everybody's call letters and names straight. I don't do that very well sometimes. Being a so-called host keeps me pretty busy. Will I get a chance to play the website, look at the video, the movie, so to speak, and understand it while all the people are talking to me and asking questions? I'm not sure. We'll give it a try. But if we don't get it tonight, we'll get it next week. Fred? Professor Cunningham, I presume the guys in Stanford that go to the college that you teach at are a little bit more informed about what's behind the front panel of the wireless equipment that they're using that they're so dependent on. I want that to be the answer. I'm a little bit afraid you're going to tell me something else. K1FC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, yeah, I got to give you a little bit of promotion here, but I had a comment on two things that had come up. One, on the interest on young people, and everybody knows that, you know, I know when I was in school, there was a lot of people were hams.
From magnetic wave, N2XJN.
When my son was in high school, he was the only ham in the whole school. But we had a very interesting experience in Connecticut this year. Somebody, or ham, decided that, who was active in Boy Scouts, but that maybe if we made a really big effort, we could get scouts interested. And so he put on, I was one of the teachers, joint big effort, a radio merit badge college, which meant for a whole day on a Saturday, we taught Boy Scouts about ham radio. Because of space, we're limited to 40. We got oversubscribed, and it looks like there'll be one or two more of these radio message colleges being put on. And of the 40, about half of the scouts indicated an interest in learning how to become ham. So the interest can be generated. I for one, was completely shocked at the amount of this. And,